Hi, my name is Tova Mervis, and my new novel is called We Would Never.
After suffering through her own contentious divorce, Tova Mervis discovered a true crime story that sparked her imagination, the story of a Florida murder that could have been the result of a contentious divorce. That spark turned into We Would Never, a murder mystery about a family who would do anything to protect its members, no matter the cost. I spoke with Tova Mervis about We Would Never, especially about complicated family dynamics and the complicated plot of this book. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Tova Mervis. Okay, so we do our best to avoid spoilers. Maybe we should start with you giving our listeners a description of the book. Tell us about We Would Never.
Sure. We Would Never is about a close-knit family in Florida who, in the wake of their daughter's divorce, might or might not have done something unimaginable. And it's a novel about a murder, but I think more than that, it's really a novel about the hard-to-solve questions of family loyalty and love and the complications of forgiveness and moving on.
I understand that the book was inspired by the news of a Florida murder during your own divorce proceedings. Is that correct?
Well, it was. It was inspired by a true crime murder that took place just after my own divorce had ended. I had a very tangential connection to somebody on Facebook, and I was scrolling Facebook and saw that this person had been murdered. And, you know, I, of course, was horrified and captivated by what had happened. And I went down the rabbit hole and started reading about this story. And a Florida State professor was shot in his car, you know, seemingly out of the blue one day in Tallahassee. And the initial speculation in the news media was that maybe he had been killed by a student who was upset about a bad grade, or maybe it was a rival legal scholar who disagreed with his positions on constitutional law. And then the last line of one of these articles said that he had been embroiled in a very contentious divorce. And I guess as someone who at the time had also recently been embroiled in a contentious divorce, I just had to wonder. And so I followed the story over the years, you know, for years and years when I was trying to write first my memoir and then a different novel, I would just come back to this story and read about it. And I always came away with the feeling that no matter how much I read about it, how many times I Googled it, I never got what I really wanted to know. I could get the facts and the criminal investigation, but I couldn't get the heart of the people, the real inner lives that would help me understand how such a story could take place.
So you mentioned this close-knit family, the Marcuses. Who are they and what should readers know about them?
Well, they're very close. They're a family that says we would do anything for each other. And that phrase really was very helpful for me in creating them as characters. I was interested in a family who has this really strong sense of loyalty to one another. They feel almost like they have to close ranks against anyone who might threaten them from the outside, and being there for one another is the supreme value in that family. And then when the youngest child in the family, Haley, marries someone who they don't like that much, but mostly doesn't really like them that much, that question of family loyalty is really put to the test.
I want to talk about the parents one at a time. So Saul, the patriarch, owns a dermatology clinic, and he's very resistant to changes that his son Nate, who is also a doctor specializing in dermatology, wants to bring to the practice, particularly offering like aesthetic treatments that potential clients are asking for. And that's just one example of the disagreement the two have had over the years. Can you give us some insight into Saul as a father, both, you know, when the kids were growing up and then once they became adults?
Sure. I think Saul is a father who loves his kids, but is more remote. He's someone who sees himself a little bit more on the sidelines. He works hard. He feels like he provides for his family, but he's not caught up in the day-to-day dramas that go on in the family, and is sort of a quieter person than everyone else in the family who holds himself at a distance. And in particular, he has a difficult relationship with his son, Nate, who ends up going into practice with him. You know, in the real story, the people in the real true crime story were dentists, and I tried to change as much as I could. So I figured dermatology was kind of a good switch. I was interested also in dermatology. I just felt like the metaphorical possibilities for that were pretty rich, with the idea of, you know, the things that, you know, seep out from inside of us onto our skin, you know, what is hidden away and what makes itself known, and sort of these growing malignancies inside of us. So it was actually very fun to do a lot of research about dermatology and to read about it. But, you know, Saul's rivalry is with his son about the direction of the practice. He is someone who holds sort of fast to the way things have always been. He wants to, I think, hold on to his own sense of power and control as he begins to recognize signs of aging in himself that really alarm him. And I think that power struggle between him and his son is really one of the exacerbating factors in this family. You know, I felt like, you know, yes, there might be a murder happening, but there's also so many family dynamics that are also at play that lead into what ultimately happens in the family.
Now, in the eyes of Haley and Nate, Sherry is a protective mother, but in the eyes of Adam and Jonah, she's controlling and toxic. Was it challenging to capture, both perspectives of Sherry?
It was, and that was one of the really hardest parts about the book. You know, where is that line between an overbearing mother and just a really loving mother? You know, where does loyalty give way to control? And I think it's hard sometimes in real life to pinpoint where that line is, but certainly in creating the character of Sherry, that was one of the things that I worked the hardest on because I wanted you, if not to necessarily like her, I wanted you to be able to relate to her. I wanted you to feel like, you know, maybe later in the book she might go a little off the rails, but at least at the start, she wants this closeness to her kids. She's given her life to raising these kids and is really grappling with an empty nest and what it means to have spent all this time being able to be so involved in her kids. And now she really suffers from the question of, you know, am I going to end up alone after all of this? You know, what happens when your kids leave you and go off into their own lives, which of course they're supposed to do, and yet what does it do to the mother who has invested her entire identity in them? And so I spent a lot of time trying to look at her from all different sides. You know, as you said, for Nate and Haley, you know, she might be a bit over the top sometimes, but they recognize that it comes from a place of love. But for characters like Adam, her middle child, and Jonah, her son-in-law, they really only see her as controlling. They find her intrusive, and there's no room for any kind of forgiveness of who she is for them.
So the Marcuses are Jewish, and while their faith doesn't dominate the book, their rituals are in the background. Does their Jewish faith guide their familial closeness?
I think I wrote about a Jewish family because I, you know, grew up in a Jewish family and so felt familiar. I think maybe that sense of being close-knit was something that I grew up with, that feeling of close connection and lots of family gatherings, particularly around holidays. And I think the way that the Jewish aspect of the book comes in most is when I explored one of the themes that was most important to me, which is the theme of forgiveness, which is a universal theme of, you know, how do you let go of a hurt someone does to you? How do you move on from something that pains you? And so I used the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, which is a ritual of atonement and forgiveness, to really think about that question for these characters and to really wrestle with, you know, in this book, so many of the characters say things like, you know, I would never do that, or I will never forgive him, or I'll never, you know, be able to forget this. And I feel like the word never, maybe in some ways, is the opposite of forgiving, where I think forgiving is about being willing to bend, being willing to soften sometimes. And I think in this book, some characters are able to, maybe too late, but some characters are not able to forgive. And so that question for me was really central, this idea of what does it mean to forgive, and what does it do to your own self when you're unable to forgive somebody?
I marked, I underlined lines all throughout the book, and one section that I want to talk about, it was in a chapter from Nate's perspective, and I'm wondering if you can comment on it because it kind of ties back to what you were talking about just a moment ago about dermatology. Nate was remembering a time when he was 10. The quote is, "Even that young, he'd sensed that he was stumbling upon a great awful truth. Everyone was damaged. Only some people bore evidence on the surface." Is there some truth to that?
I mean, I thought about it first, you know, as a dermatology reference. You know, I did have fun, you know, reading about dermatology and thinking about, you know, the metaphorical ideas of what we carry hidden inside of us and what we carry on the surface. And I think for me as a writer, maybe the thing that moves me most to write fiction is about the gap between who we are on the outside and who we are on the inside. And I'm always moved by the sort of, saying, you never know what story someone is living inside of, or we interact with people and we never know the deeper pain people are struggling with. We never know what else is going on in someone's life. And I think that, I guess the line you read was really, I think, comes out of that feeling for me, that I think we all bear some kind of pain. Very few of us make it to adulthood and the years behind unscathed. And, some of us carry smaller pains and some of us carry enormous pains, and some are well hidden and some are right there where we can't hide them from other people. But I feel like in creating characters, I always want to think about that question of, what are those pains hidden inside? What is everyone reacting from and carrying with them? And so I think that line is very much my own impulse as a writer to really mine that sense of hidden pain for all the characters.
Can you talk about the structure of the book? Because we have a couple of timelines involved. Chapters alternate through perspectives. The main 2019 timeline is actually Haley journaling. And I'm envisioning your writing space as, a war room type office with walls filled with post-its and string. How do you keep track of who knows what has been revealed to the reader and such?
It's funny, you can see in the background my war room. This is where I wrote, but it's cleaned up now. It has been strewn with post-it notes and my desktop. I mean, my files were like, I have like new novel one, notes for new novel one, new novel two. I think the draft that I sent to my editor was called new novel 58. So it has gone through so many iterations and so many versions, and the timeline was challenging. It's funny how certain things about a book you discover in the years of writing it, and certain things you know right away. And really, from the moment I decided I was going to write this book, I knew there were going to be two timelines. Fairly early on, I knew the second timeline, which was going to be set in Maine, was going to have dogs in it. I do not know why, but it was like there are going to be dogs. I didn't actually have a dog at the time. I have since become a very much a dog person, but at the time I was not yet a dog person. But that structure, that question of how do you move one, both, it's like two parallel train tracks, and how do you move the trains forward and switch between them and not get too far ahead of yourself in one place and not reveal something in one timeline that really needs to be kept secret for the other timeline. And so it was patience, it was years of frustration, a lot of looking at it and being like, wait, no, this doesn't work. I have to un like re you know stitching something together and undoing. But I like being able to switch between the two timelines. I felt like the second timeline, that is Haley's writing or journaling, was a way to shed light on the other timeline. It was a way to sort of metabolize some of the questions that were being raised in the first section and the family thread, as I called it, and to think about the later impact that this story has on Haley as a character. But I love a good post-it note. I love a note card. And there are times when the only way for me to see it, I'm very visual. I make put note cards, I spread them on the floor, I look at them, I look like some kind of mad scientist as I move them all around and switch them back and forth to create that sense of structure and flow.
So those chapters that were Haley's journaling, they weren't the only mentions of the secrets she kept in a diary. Do you keep a diary?
Well, so I used to as a child. My mother recently cleaned out my childhood closet and delivered to me many boxes of my early childhood writings and, postcards and notes and letters and these little diaries with these little gold locks on them. And so I don't really keep a diary anymore, but I think I'm always making notes of some kind. I feel like the only way for me to really understand something is to write about it. And so I have just files in my usually on my computer, or sometimes on random scraps of paper. But I think writing is a way for me to sort of flesh out what I'm really thinking and a way to understand something. And I feel like I can't really start to think deeply unless I'm in some ways involved in writing, whether it's on my computer or in a notebook.
I found the remarks from social media interesting. It was almost like a Greek chorus. Since the advent of web-based and social media, don't read the comments is a common piece of advice. Talk to me about why Haley felt compelled to read the comments, and did they have influence over her?
Right, as a writer, don't read the comments is one of my guiding principles. It never does any good, but I also understand, of course, the impulse that, Haley finds herself all of a sudden in the middle of this media frenzy, this speculation that, was she involved in the murder? Was her parents? This sort of finds herself in the midst of this onslaught, which is a new phenomenon relatively with social media, where it's not that she's just a person people might see in a news program, or see her picture in the newspaper, but social media gives access to her. We can all email the real people we see in these news stories. We can direct message them. We have ways of being in contact with these news stories that I think fundamentally change any sense of privacy and divisions between public and private. And so for Haley, she doesn't want to read the comments where people are speculating about her involvement, and yet she's compelled to. It's that push and pull of, I don't want to know and I must know. And I guess maybe as a writer, I know what that feels like. So I think I understand that urge and that urge to both hide and to come toward the comment. But for her, it's this sense that people are debating, what she might or might have done. They're speculating. Everyone feels so certain that they know a truth that she's not even sure of herself.
Well, the book is We Would Never. Tova Mirvis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Tova Mirvis, author of the book We Would Never, which was published by Avid Reader Press. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.